Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Drew Meredith, welcome back to the Australian Investors Podcast, mate.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's great, mate. We're continuing on our passive income series. If you do want to get in contact with us, be sure to send us an email, podcast@rask.com.au. Send us your questions because we're going to be talking and answering questions in the final installment of this five-part series. But today we're on part two and we're talking about the defensive side of a portfolio. Not only the defensive side, but also the defensive alternative side of a portfolio. So here we're talking about bonds, we're talking about high yield, we're talking about credit in various guises. And we're going to break down Drew's, I guess, strategy for active versus passive across these buckets, how to think about alternatives. We might even mention, you know, term deposits or TDs and those types of things too. Drew, just maybe to set the scene for our listeners, what are the most common types of bonds and bond funds or ETFs? And what place do they have in a diversified portfolio?
Yeah, this is probably the most exciting part of portfolio construction, isn't it? Fixed income and bonds. Maybe it is.
Oh, I've got it. It's got to be.
I'm stretching it there. I'm trying to get the energy and ramp it up a little bit.
No, you're doing well.
I'll get serious. There's three types of bonds, which is quite confusing. And there's a lot of subtypes underneath. So government bonds. Clearly, US government, Australian government, that only takes the federal level of government. So in semi-government bonds, you probably think it's like public-private partnerships, but it tends to be more state government bonds fall into the semi-government, even though they're still government. They're just called semi-government for some reason. And then corporate bonds. So, you know, for instance, something issued by Woolies or Commonwealth Bank, and that can spread the entire part of a company's balance sheet or capital stack, as they call it. So there's, you know, asset-backed securities, there's hybrids, which we'll talk about, a massive spread of underlying subtypes there as well.
Okay. So how big is the bond market? And I guess why are we talking about this today? We know that there are standard 60-40 portfolios and all that sort of stuff, but why are we talking about it? Why is it important?
Apparently, there's a little stats I found over the weekend that the global bond market is $120 trillion US dollars. So massive in size. So you think every state, every country that's running deficit or has some sort of government debt, it's huge. By comparison, the Aussie corporate bond market is about $2 trillion. And I think what's the ASX at the moment? I think it's about $2 or $3 trillion as well. So
yeah, it's somewhere in that range.
Capital size, about the same size as the ASX. So clearly an important part of how companies are funding themselves to grow and keep operating, I think is one thing we kind of forget about in fixed income, that it's capital, instead of having equity, it's capital to help businesses grow and acquire and innovate. The other side of the balance sheet.
Yeah. So I mean, there are plenty of resources out there for people to learn about bonds and I guess just like the basics of them. But like you said, it's a different part of the capital stack. We've got for a company, it's, you know, that permanent or not permanent, but, you know, long-term funding typically pays, you know, an interest back to the investors, and they go and invest that money in projects with a higher ROI. And for governments, it's very much the same. It's used to stimulate the economy and so on and so forth. So what do investors get? Just a quick one. What do investors get from investing in bond portfolios?
The old adage of diversification. So bonds should typically interact or perform differently in different market environments compared to equities. Bonds tend to outperform in recessions or difficult environments for equity markets. They provide income and pretty much close to guaranteed or the risk-free rate of income. And with that is capital security. So depending on who you're lending to, it's a legislated agreement that you get your money back at the end, or you get your $100 that you invested back at the end. So they're kind of the three benefits. And, you know, I think this 60-40 portfolio has had its worst start one of the worst, six worst starts in 100 years, according to another podcast I was listening to. Wow. So some of the diversification benefits haven't worked so far, but that in the environment we're in today, it kind of changes and potentially flips the script on the 60-40 for the next few years too.
Yeah, and we saw that during the GFC too, where a lot of things that investors thought weren't correlated turned out to move very similarly during that period of uncertainty. So it is important that when we look at diversifiers in portfolios that we acknowledge that uncertainty and that relationship. You know, we've talked about Bitcoin not being, or at least some people did, talked about Bitcoin being a diversifier for portfolios. And as at the date of this recording, it's probably not turning out to be that so much. Okay, so let's just go through these buckets quickly, Drew, and how you use them in portfolios at Wattle Partners and how most advisors would use them. So let's talk about government bonds. Like you said, federal government bonds, US, Australian, European, whatever. How are they used and why are they used in portfolios?
Yeah, I think it's probably worth touching on the types of strategies you can get to drum down to that too. So you got passive like you do in equities, which is index tracking. So essentially the more you issue in debt, the larger your position is in an index. So sometimes it's counterintuitive. Active is where groups are betting, you know, betting on duration or taking more risk in different countries to generate higher returns in the benchmark. Then you've got single sector, which would be like that fund only invests into hybrids or that fund only invests into high quality corporate or high yield bonds. And then multi-strategy or multi-sector, which invests across, could hold some hybrids, could hold some emerging market debt, and so on. You know, there's probably about 50 sub-asset classes in there. How we use government bonds, traditionally it's just a diversifier. So the first step we take when we're building client portfolios is to understand how much capital or how much income they're going to spend or how much income they need for the next three to 5 years, and then always ensure they've got enough money in low risk investments that if the rest of the market collapsed 40% and stayed there for 10 years, we know we could sell the lower risk government semi corporate bonds and pay for their income. And that kind of gives that sleep at night comfort that portion of your portfolio is taken care of all the time. It's kind of been challenged this year. So, or at least the passive approach has been challenged this year because increasing interest rates has sent the value of bonds across the board down at the same time equity markets are falling. Internally, we've applied more of an active approach to bonds, which means it's performed very differently to that. So essentially, it's a diversifier, something to sell if everything hits the fan. I won't swear on the podcast. And a source of cash when you need it.
So, Drew, how about then semi-government bonds? Where would we have them sit in a portfolio and how are they maybe different to, or if they're not different at all, to like federal government bonds?
I think in the nature of fixed income, semi-government is very similar to Commonwealth government. You know, it's kind of essentially guaranteed by, you know, state government. If a state government goes bankrupt, clearly the Commonwealth government's going to bail them out to make sure hospitals and everything keep running. So there's an implicit guarantee there. I think the benefit is you can pull some other levers on credit risk, duration, and liquidity. So you might find more mispricings in state government bonds because less people invest in them. The way fixed income works for a lot of groups and pension funds is they're only allowed to invest into certain ratings or certain portions of government, semi-government, and corporate. So sometimes you've got people pulling out of sectors or buying into sectors, which creates mispricing opportunities. So I think generally your yield's a little bit higher. Duration's probably similar, but slightly less liquid just because it's a smaller market than the $1 trillion in debt we have at a Commonwealth level.
So for most investors, the corporate market is probably where a lot of their attention goes because it is quite varied in terms of you've got the full spectrum of credit ratings, you've got multiple markets, multiple industries, you know, it can be sector specific, so on and so forth. This is something that we've spoken about on the show before, and we're going to talk about things like hybrids and all that in a minute. But where do you use like corporate bonds in the portfolios?
I think depending on, we probably view it on credit rating and credit risk. So initially you'd assume highly rated corporates like Woolworths, CBA, I keep bringing up Woolworths infrastructure assets, you're probably seeing them as the core. But as you move down the risk spectrum and you start to go into sub-investment grade, what they call high yield, then they start to creep into their kind of defensive alternatives where there's a little bit more risk of capital loss or volatility, even if it's very small. I think one of the keys here is that you should be and you do get paid more for taking more risk. So the Commonwealth government bonds considered the risk-free rate in the old capital asset pricing model. State government should pay a little bit more income than that. And then corporate bonds will pay almost a premium over the 10-year government bond yield. And the 10-year Aussie government bond yield is about, give or take, 3.1% at the moment. So naturally, your corporate bonds are starting to pay things like 3, 4, 5%. So I think, I mean, the primary source you look for is income and that diversification benefit of acting differently when markets fall, just not in this crisis, which is a little bit unique in history.
And here we can see that we'll get things like floating rates and we'll get things that are linked, right? So we can get some protection from, I guess, the sensitivity of bonds to interest rate rises or inflation and those types of things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, government and semi-government are pretty much all fixed rate bonds. And that's why you've seen them, as interest rates increase, a fixed rate bond is worth less on the market if you sold it today. But obviously, you get your money back if you wait till maturity. Whereas as you move into corporate and then you move into private credit, even more so, pretty much everything becomes floating rate, or at least a big selection of floating rate. So, you know, your income, your interest payment is reset every quarter or every 6 months based on a percentage, a fixed percentage above the prevailing market rate. So like say bank bill swap rate plus 3% is an example for a hybrid or preference share.
So we've talked a lot about, I guess, from a high level, how we can think about the different buckets. How then do you go about picking funds to invest in, whether they be through like your ETF vehicle, active or passive, whatever? What are you looking at? Like, I've asked you in anticipation for today's show to think of like some, maybe like five things that investors can consider when they're studying or researching a bond fund, you know, which goes into your process, I guess.
Yeah, so the first one and particularly relevant at the moment is interest rate duration. So duration is the sensitivity of the portfolio of bonds to movement in interest rates. If your duration is, say, 5 or the index is 7, if interest rates go up 1% like they have in like the last 4 weeks, you can have a capital loss on the value of about 7%. That's a kind of inverse relationship. So that has incredibly relevant last year and in the lead up to interest rate hikes, but less relevant. Maybe less relevant, maybe more relevant now, that interest rates have increased and bonds have fallen in value pretty significantly, about 15%. The next one would be credit spread duration, which is the same concept, how sensitive the value of the bond is to movements in interest rates, but this time it's the how sensitive they are to movements in the spread of higher return that you get in different credit ratings. So, you know, traditionally, say it's a BBB versus an A-rated bond, you're paid an extra 2.5%. If that spreads out to, say, 3%, then, you know, it's looking more attractive. And if it's 1.5, then that's where you're starting to look at credit spread duration. So if the market spread moves, you lose how much capital are you going to gain or lose in that situation? It's quite detailed concepts for fixed income investments. It's not as easy as a PE ratio.
No, it's not as easy as a PE ratio, but it makes sense, right? It makes sense. So, and I think that, yeah, that kind of relates to the next point.
Credit quality. So, you know, what is the credit rating of the individual bonds that are held in that portfolio? And what is the rating of that portfolio when it's all held together? Obviously, you can take more. There's two different ways to take risk. You can take duration risk and bet that interest rates will fall. Or you can take credit risk and bet that, you know, perceived higher risk companies are going to be fine and you're going to get paid more for effectively lending them capital. So, there's also this kind of unique thing that anything that isn't AAA or triple B or higher is called junk, but there is simply, you know, I think over 50% of all the companies in the world are sub-investment grade. So those companies aren't all going bankrupt. They're just either not interested in getting a credit rating, it's too expensive, or not relevant to them, and they're happy to pay the higher rates that come with it. I think concentration would be the fourth. You know, there's very little there's very little upside in fixed income and bonds. So you want to make sure you're protecting the downside as much as possible. So concentration, meaning you've got a diverse range of borrowers, same as you'd look at diversification in an equity portfolio.
Sorry, Drew, just on that, what would be an example of a bond portfolio that is concentrated, or is this like a kind of depends on where it sits? If it's defensive alts or in the core, you might have like a very typical diversified bond fund in the core, but then you're happy to take concentration in that, in the defensive alts?
I think you always want diversification, whether it's in the core or not. I think you're going to be concentrated in a benchmark hugging or a passive strategy, because the US and Australian government bonds dominate about 60 to 70%, like the MSCI and equities. But just because there are so many issues, there's so many company specific risks, the more holdings you get, the more true example you get of the bond market, not just of even a sub sleeve of the bond market. You're trying to look at it in individual sleeves so you can assess the risk of each of those. And that's, you know, it could be finding out what sectors they're lending to. Are they lending too much to leisure sectors, to tourism, to sectors of the economy that may be struggling, or property, or wherever it happens to be? And the last one is pretty simple, which is yield. So running yield being the kind of the trailing interest you've been paid based on the most recent payment, and yield to maturity, which is based on the dollar value you pay today, what annualized yield you're going to get if that's repaid at $100 at the end of the term.
Okay. And I know there's one extra thing that you wanted to tack on the end here, which is, I guess, just the size and experience. So can you tell me a bit more about this?
Yeah, I think bond markets are pretty unique, that a lot of the trading is still over the counter. You know, that like literally you pick up a phone, ask someone how much they'll pay for an asset. There's obviously you can see more information on some of the ASX-run systems, but it's very, very small community and very, you know, yeah, less transparent than equity is probably the easiest way to say it. So having size and experience in the market, even just who you know, knowing all the other counterparties that might be interested in your bonds is more important than anything. And then there's a lot of, obviously people are, bonds are debt, so there's always a need to roll over debt or issue new debt. So being able to negotiate with issuers and get good terms when they're issuing new debt, or making sure you're on the priority and you're getting access to those, could be a hybrid, capital note, whatever it is, making sure you're able to guarantee access to the ones you want, and you can't just pop up tomorrow and get that.
Mm. So listeners will know that we're talking about, normally when we talk portfolios from a high level, we just say, you know, risk on, risk off assets. We have like, typically we talk about equities on the risk on or growth side, and then on the risk off we have bonds or cash or whatever. But when we talk to you, it's talking about like the four buckets. And today we're also exploring the one of those buckets, which is defensive alts. And I'm going to give you a bit of a pop quiz in a minute of different types of strategies and where they fall into these different buckets, so people can really get a sense of how you use them. But how about hybrids? In Australia, hybrids are hugely popular, particularly amongst slightly older investors and investors who are transitioning for that income. And this is what this series is all about, passive income, right? So where do hybrids in particular sit? Do you use them? I guess is another part of that. And then we can maybe, there is one listed product here that I know of, which is the BetaShares hybrid ETF. I think it's like an active fund or managed fund or something like that, but it's listed on the exchange under HBRD. So maybe if that's an example or not, you can take that and run with it. But I guess hybrids in general, how are you using them, where they fall?
Yeah, we've been long proponents of hybrids. They're hybrids, so they're part equity and part debt. they tend to, more recently, they've fallen into our fixed income rather than our defensive alternatives, but there's a case to be made for probably for either. I'd say our view has always been there's a difference between a bank or an insurance company hybrid and a corporate hybrid, like Seven preference shares, which we held many years ago. And that being banks and insurance companies have capital adequacy requirements and they constantly have to report to APRA and authorities to make sure they have enough capital on their balance sheet to, you know, to meet the worst case scenario effectively. So we don't touch anything outside of bank issued hybrids in our fixed income component. And if we see an opportunity in a higher risk hybrid, that'd fall into the equity, which it just complicates matters even more, likely trying to explain why a hybrid goes in there. But I think they've been volatile. So March 2020, some hybrids traded from $100 down to about $85. It was essentially people were selling anything they had. Not that there was anything wrong or they thought they were going to go, you know, fall over. Essentially, people were selling everything they had to cash up and hopefully buy something else or just cash up essentially. And hybrids were usually you go from your lowest risks down when you go to cash and you sell your equities last is how a lot of people think. But they're essentially an important source of capital for the banking sector. So what you're betting on is that banks won't risk their reputation and their ability to raise further capital by not redeeming a preference share at the $100 par value. I mean, there's talk that banks, one or two banks nearly were insolvent during the GFC. I think probably spoken about who they might be, but it's irrelevant because they weren't. And when worse comes to worse, you know, the bank government guarantee came in. There's the four pillars of the banking system is always going to be reasonably well supported, but there is the risk if one of them went insolvent, they could convert your investment to equity and you could have, you know, a capital loss of 40 to 50%. We think that's incredibly unlikely. And the high yield, which at the moment I think is about 4 to 4.5%, is more attractive. It is enough kind of reward for the very small risk of that happening.
Was there, Drew, I was just Googling, did the NAB hybrids get converted during the COVID crash? I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
Now, there's always the option, not the option to convert. It's just quite a unique structure because the hybrids are technically issued by a separate entity of the bank, and then the bank resells, essentially purchases those back, I think is the correct explanation. I'm happy to take commentary on whether that's right or not, but it's always a separate entity. If you convert a debt instrument to equity, you're not going to be raising that debt instrument again, or you're going to be paying 7 or 8% to do it, which is the reputation risk that they carry if they don't.
Yeah, right. Because I shouldn't be doing this live on air, but I remember seeing that like some of the NAB hybrids got whacked during COVID, but it could have just been like just the face value, like the price of the hybrids. But so I've kind of taken us on a bit of a tangent there. So you could make a case for them fitting in either side.
We happened to buy in during that period.
Okay, right. And did you keep holding them, or was it just more like an arbitrage shorter term play?
No, so there was a very big difference between the performance of hybrids that we're going to redeem in the next 12 months and hybrids that we're going to redeem in 5 years. The longer term ones fell off significantly more. So while some fell from 100 to 95, others fell from 100 to 85. So we saw this arbitrage, made the decision that we didn't think the banks would collapse, sold the short, bought the long. They all traded back to 100 within about 4 weeks. It was the quickest kind of arbitrage I've seen. There's sort of additional returns you can generate. And a few other kind of listed investment trusts had a similar experience where it was due to the forced seller rather than a problem with the investment.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, so that if there's that type of dislocation, again, I think that's a good way to kind of compartmentalize that, like where is the issue coming from? Like you said, if there's – and you said it before about the timing and strategies of institutional capital on the bond side of portfolios, bond markets, how that can impact things. So, again, we're talking about like defensive and defensive alts. I'm going to just give you, say, four things and four different types of products or investments that people could make. And I'm going to be very specific here about the types of investments. And I'm going to ask you to give me just like a 20-second response to these, like where they fall, if they're purely defensive or if they're defensive alts for you at Waddle Partners. And maybe just imagine, like, I don't know, a 50-year-old couple or single investor balance risk profile. So just like really generic. And obviously when we answer these questions, we're just being very general in nature. We're not talking about anyone in particular. Just want to emphasize that. But on the show in the past, Drew, and I'm going to ask you for allocations as well. So not just where do they fall, but how much could potentially go into this type of investment. So on the show in the past, we had Andrew Swarth from Qualitas. So this is a high quality real estate debt fund. It's listed on the ASX under the ticker symbol QRI. Where would this fall?
I tend to, without knowing the product that well, I tend to say defensive alternatives, high yield, singular kind of asset class exposure to property underneath. So likely in defensive alternatives because it's listed, it'll be a bit more volatile. So we kind of separate volatility, fixed income versus defensive alternatives. And I'd say anywhere from 10 to 20% of that defensive alternative sleeve, which means, you know, you might have five investments in your defensive alternative sleeve.
Okay, that makes sense. And how about something like vanilla, like the Vanguard Australian Fixed Interest ETF? It trades under the ticker symbol VAF.
Core. So, you know, you're tracking the Bloomberg Global or no, the Australian Aggregate Bond Index. So essentially it's 60% or 70% Australian Commonwealth Government bonds. Core now, probably 50%. If you talked to me in December last year, I would have said, don't hold anything because it's long duration. But that's starting to change. But in a normal environment where you're expecting bonds to perform well and or provide a ballast, then you're looking at as much as 50% of your core fixed income allocation.
Yeah. So just to emphasize then, so if you're saying if you're at a 60-40 portfolio and hypothetically you had, you know, of that 40%, 30% was in your core, then you're saying 50% of that, just to confirm like what, yeah, where we're going with this. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I just say 40%. Yeah. Just say it's all core. That's the easiest way to assume it.
Yeah. Yeah. But so people, we just don't want you to think that it's like 50% of all of your risk off assets should be in this one ETF. Okay. So what about a REIT? So we've had REITs on the show before, like managers and whatever, and there are certain aspects of it where people might be thinking, oh, you know, it pays a reasonably consistent yield, it's diversified, like something like Goodman Group, which is a massive part of, say, the VAP ETF here in Australia. Where would something like Goodman Group, a REIT, sit?
So when we look at defensive versus growth alternatives, we think it fits property and real estate and infrastructure fits into alternatives. We look at what's the history of capital losses and what's the volatility. A-REITs have been more volatile or similarly volatile to equity markets, so it fits into growth alternatives for us because it's a bit more equity-like. You know, probably even though the asset base would be potentially the same, unlisted longer-term trusts probably fit more closely to defensive alternatives because they're less volatile. Goodman Group's down at, I think, more than 10% or something recently, but high quality. So growth alternatives. And then within that, you're probably having 5 to 7 individual investments. So 10 to 15% of the growth alternatives bucket.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But so this is interesting because some people would see REITs as a defensive play, for whatever reason. So like whether it's inflation being linked to inflation and higher CPI pushing, you know, rental yields higher or whatever. Okay, so that's growth alternatives. Final one, which is probably a bit of low-hanging fruit, which is like imagine you've got like a Macquarie Bank account, you've got a TD, like a term deposit. Where does that sit?
We tend to say if it's under 12 months, it's in cash. If it's over 12 months to maturity, it's in fixed interest because it's not easily accessible and there's potentially break fees. And we'd say, you know, as much as 30, depending on the rate on offer, which is actually about 30, you can get about 3% for some 2-year term deposits now, as much as 30% of that portfolio. But it really depends on, yeah, what return you're trying to achieve because obviously you're guaranteeing that return. Great if markets fall, not so great if interest rates keep going up and you're missing out on return. So up to 30% probably
Yeah, right. Call. Okay. It's crazy. Like, do you think a year ago we were talking about lucky to get a 1% interest rate, and now we're getting 3% potentially on some bank accounts and term deposits. Okay, so just to recap there, in terms of where they sit, we've got like a real estate debt fund that would be in defensive alts. Then we've got the VAF ETF, which is diversified Aussie fixed interest. That's right in the core fixed income allocation. A REIT like Goodman Group is growth alternatives, not defensive alternatives. And a TD, depending on what it is cash or fixed interest in that core. Okay, great. So I guess the one thing that's really interesting to investors right now is credit and high yield. You mentioned before that sub-investment grade could be as much as 50% of issues sit below that line. How can investors access that marketplace? Because, you know, can they go directly like they can with equities, or what's the preferred way in your opinion?
I think the challenge of bond and fixed income markets is they're structured for wholesale and institutional investors. So the minimum investment in some cases, like $1 million for a single bond, and no one can do that. So we tend to use specialist fund managers in different sectors of the market. There's a growing range of, what do you call them, securitization groups that also, you know, apply for $50 million in bonds and then break them up and separate them out. We've never gone along that track, adding another, you know, broking firm. We think we can generally get an expert in the industry that'll manage an entire portfolio with a single objective rather than trying to, you know, put together bond issues on a regular basis. I think hybrids you can clearly buy on the ASX or through a through the ETF we might have discussed earlier. And then we tend to go look at all the different sleeves of the fixed income market. Which parts of the capital stack of company do we want to be exposed to? Like real estate backed credit, like Qualitas mortgages, commercial property backed debt, normal corporate debt, green bonds, so bonds issued by, say, Woolies that have to put solar panels on their roof, private equity, so lending money to private equity that is taking over companies. There's a growing and massive range of opportunities there, and you can get very niche in terms of exactly what security you want and what groups you want to partner with.
We'll get to some of like whether you go passive or active in certain things in just a moment, but do you have some examples of managers that you've found to be really impressive across any of these buckets? So like whether it's credit, whether it's Aussie fixed interest, global fixed interest, semis, whatever, any managers that stood out to you or currently stand out to you, and why? I'd be interested in the why.
Yeah, I think there'd be a different one for each part of the capital stack. So Coolabah, you know, you would have you interviewed Chris Joy before?
Yeah.
They Barton's do basically. He's one of the smartest in Australia at like Australian government bond and semi-government. And then I think he manages one of BetaShares hybrid ETFs as well. That might be the active management. And then we slip into different parts of the asset classes. So Metrics, I think you've maybe interviewed Andrew Lockhart. So he's basically
no, I haven't actually.
Massive That's another one for the list. Non-bank financial institution. Something like, is it zero to, maybe it's 8 billion or more. Sorry if it's wrong. But they're a listed investment trust that has a pool of, I think, a lot of real estate-backed debt and other issues. So you can buy them on the market, and you can also buy them as a fund. Yarra Capital have – there's a guy over there that used to run the Victorian Funds Management Corporation credit portfolio. So he has a credit strategy at Yarra. And then Elsion, who are – probably one of the longest standing real estate, private real estate backed debt managers. I think they're probably in four different sleeves of the portfolio. And that's most of that is about depth, experience, and as I said before, knowing the people in the industry and know who you're dealing with.
Mm. So who would be the most impressive that you've come across in your time?
I left this one out, which is, it's, you know, bond managers are probably more interesting than equity managers. We found there's a Franklin Templeton has an absolute return fixed income team, which means they're essentially trying to generate a positive return in every environment. Two portfolio managers and then analysts, so Andrew Kenobi and damn it, I can't remember his colleague's name, but I'm sure I'll come up with it. So that's long short. They're flexible duration, so they haven't had to take interest rate risk as interest rates have risen. They can be negative and positive duration, and essentially they're trying to find mispricings in bond issues and corporate bonds all over Australia and sometimes around the world as well.
Is this Chris Siniakov?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, Chris. So the kind of insight they provide into their portfolio, and almost to invest in the bond market in Australia, you have to have an insight into how the government is operating and how monetary policy is operating. So they're two of probably the smartest bond managers I've met.
Yeah, right. Okay. So I've got two more questions for you, and maybe we can take this one as a bit of a punchy question as well. So I'm just going to ask you, do you prefer to have passive or active exposure here? And I'm going to give you some examples. So how about in Aussie corporate bonds, do you prefer to go active or passive here, and why?
I prefer active in Aussie corporate. I think there's heaps of relative value opportunities. There's a diverse range of companies, the corporate bond benchmark will favour the companies that issue the most debt or the most levered companies. And I think there's heaps of opportunity for information asymmetry and for bond managers to do research and gain an edge from that.
Okay. In global fixed interest, obviously, often we see these as currency hedged global fixed interest portfolios. Would you prefer these to be passive or active when you're building out that core?
I think the concentration of global fixed income, where there's 70% or so in US treasuries, just means you're better off starting as a passive approach for that. It's very difficult to take enough risk to outperform the benchmark when it's so big. So passive on that one. More comfortable with that today than 6 months ago.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so final question here, which is a bit of a a teaser for you. And this is just to round out a bit of this conversation with a kind of strategy or quote from Warren Buffett, who said that he'd invest his estate or his wife's inheritance into 90% equity index funds and 10% into short-term government bonds, so treasuries. That's basically a 90-10 portfolio. What do you think?
My real answer or?
Yeah, give us your real answer. Go on. Don't hold back. This is a truth podcast.
I love Warren Buffett. I think he's incredible, but I think he's the most overquoted person in finance. It's one of the things of say one thing and do another. So if you look at how he invests, we talked about this a couple of podcasts ago, didn't we? He invests completely the opposite as the way he tells everyone else to invest. So his biggest holdings in Apple, he takes companies private. He takes complete control. I think he's more likely to invest his wife's inheritance in Berkshire and never touch it would be the more likely result. Essentially, you're buying high quality businesses, letting them compound is what his whole premise is, not buying benchmark and short term govy debt.
Okay, then. Well, then, how about this then? As a if we zoom out of Buffett,
sorry, Warren.
Yeah, that's a sin, mate, in finance. How about if we zoom out of Buffett for a second and we just think of the allocation of 90-10 and broad-based across both equities and bonds. We're not so bored when you've got treasuries, but how do you think about that? Like if you had a younger person, an 18-year-old coming in, would you suggest that something like that is appropriate, just generally speaking?
Yeah, I think if you put away capital for emergencies and you're taking care of your lifestyle, then 90-10 would be fine. You got 10% sitting there for, go in and out of cash, pay bills, pay fees if you need to. I think it's fine. And then we probably have a starting point that's 50-50. Yes, perfect split of 50-50. And then do you need more income? Do you pursuing more growth? And you move the dial from there. And then even if you've got 90% in equities, you can, or in markets, you can always introduce alternatives like growth alternatives that are less volatile depending on the conditions if you're not as comfortable. So for a young person, that's fine. Older, you're gradually moving towards it, but depending on your expectations. So if you don't want to leave any capital to your children, well, you could probably just hold term deposits, but you'll quickly spend it down. If you're balancing growth and income, then you're starting to look towards a balanced or balanced growth kind of portfolio. At the moment, it's probably around the 40-60, just with a different makeup to the traditional 40-60.
Mm, okay. One thing I'll just catch you off guard here is, do you remember hear about that that idea that you want your age in bonds? Have you come across that one? So, like, if you're 50, you'd have 50%? Or
I wish investing was that easy. and you'd hate to have done that now, because the US bond market is down 18% in 6 months. So if you had 80% of your capital there, well, that's down to, what, like 60, 65%, you've lost 15% in 6 months. So I think there's so many other considerations to have there. And really, you just got to tie how much you have in low risk to how much, what return you want to achieve, because ultimately that is the drag on your returns over the long term. So if you need 3% per annum, then buy a term deposit. And then that should be your starting point. If you don't need to take risk, don't take it, and then incrementally take it on the way up.
Yeah, cool. That's a good way to end the show, mate. So this is episode 2 of Passive Income on the Australian Investors Podcast. You can find Drew Meredith at waddlepartners.com.au, and all the links will be in the show notes. Please send us your questions, because we like to bring this conversation to life. Remember that we're talking about building a properly diversified portfolio that can produce passive income. And we're exploring not just, as you heard in this episode, ETFs, we're talking about managed funds, we're talking about tax. We talked in the first episode about tax and growth alternatives, defensive alternatives. We're going to have a hypothetical scenario in an upcoming episode where I put Drew to the test. I give him a situation, and we're going to work through that and build a portfolio out of it. And then we're going to talk about different risks and mistakes that people make in building this type of portfolio. So Drew's going to bring to the table some ways that people definitely will go wrong. And then finally, we've got the Q&A session. So you can send your questions to podcast@rask.com.au. That's podcast@rask.com.au. Please use the subject line passive in your email, because we're probably going to get quite a few emails, and we want to prioritize those that are associated with this series. So please do that. Drew Meredith, Certified Financial Planner, thanks for taking the time to join me on the podcast today, mate.
Thanks for having me again.